Good afternoon. So last time we talked about two-phase commit. The idea with two-phase commit was that this was a way in which we could provide distributed transactions. Namely, we'd have multiple machines across which some operation needed to be split, and we'd have them perform the operation all together, and we'd make sure we had consensus on what was going to happen. And that it happened, you know, either happened or didn't, not something in between. And our key idea is that before we did the operation, the worker and the coordinator, everyone involved, would agree that, yes, we're doing this, and there'd be no takebacks. And we'd enforce that by requiring the machines to have some sort of logging, where even if they had a failure, that decision would be recorded in their log, so they wouldn't go back from it. Now, because we required everyone to do the thing together, two-phase commit had what I call blocking on failure, meaning that if things failed in the wrong time, we'd have to wait to figure out what happened. We couldn't just make progress without everyone else. Which makes sense because, you know, our kind of assumption was that each worker machine was kind of critical to the operation. We also mentioned briefly, but didn't go into the details on how you implement it, the idea that we can take this idea of voting on, you know, whether we agree to do the operation, but not require everyone to be involved and have some sort of majority be required. And this doesn't work in our two-phase commit scenario where everyone's kind of integral to the transaction we want to do. But if everyone duplicates the data, we could have a system that keeps working when we have enough machines working. And this is something that's commonly used in practice. We're not going to go through the details this semester. You know, the trickiest thing that we didn't mention is, like, what do we do when the equivalent of the coordinator stops working? Okay. So that's what we discussed last time. And for the rest of the day, I intend to go over one last distributed systems talk to talk about network file systems, and then talk a bit about security. But before I move on, any questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so logistics note, last week's post quiz is due Thursday. So Thursday at 12:15 p.m. before the first lecture time. And two-phase is due next Monday, as per announcements you got for both of these in email. But So our new topic I mentioned, network file systems. So what did I mean? What is a network file system? So one example is that the department has a bunch of machines, and when they're working, you can SSH into them, and there's actually like more than one machine backing SSH or remote desktop that the department offers, but on all of them, you have the same files. So how does that work? Well, the multiple machines you SSH into are each talking to a network file server as a client, and that's where your files are actually stored. And this is where the actual file system is. And we're going to talk today about how we design the way this communication protocol. And we're going to start by thinking about sort of a simple idea for doing this, which is based on RPC. So we're going to think about doing this with remote procedure calls. And you know that we need to think about, well, what procedure calls do we make to actually access files normally? And if you think about those are our system calls. Our system calls, like our function calls when we use them from C programs. And we could just take those and turn them into remote procedure calls. So we could just say when you call open, well, rather than just processing that in a local kernel, since the files are in another machine, we'll just send that over with the remote procedure call to another machine. We'll just convert our system calls into remote procedure calls. And this seems like a reasonable sort of idea, but we're going to see that it has some problems where we're going to want sort of a different design philosophy. And this problem, we're going to start coming up with, well, what does it require the server to do? And our second issue, which is going to be actually more pressing, is what do we want to do in the case of failures? So for what does it require the server to do? Well, we need to store stuff on the server. So what are we storing on the server? Well, we have to keep track of all these open files. Open's returning a file descriptor. We have to correlate those two things together. So we need to remember for each client process, so each process on a client machine, you know, what file it has open for each file descriptor, and information about that, like offset and file, you know, read, write, and so on. Everything, you know, what we stored locally in the PCB, these list of files, open files. That all needs to be stored on the server. There's also something about the current working directory. That's something we need to know to interpret open. And when we think about this, this has a bit of a problem, namely that we think about storing these, we have a problem where we have this mix of local and non-local files, typically. So if you SSH into portal, like your home directory, so you comp ID, this is on the network file server versus say /temp will be local. And it makes sense to have /temp be local because that's going to be a lot faster. And commonly we'll have this mix of local and non-local files. So this is kind of one reason why we're not going to do everything on the server. And for example, the current working directory, you know, that doesn't make sense to store on the server for that reason, because we want, you know, when we're in /temp, we want that to be kind of local. So we want some indirection here. But it seems like this, well, this is a bunch of stuff to store, but maybe it's not so bad. Now, this isn't great, but it's manageable. So let's say many clients. How many clients could we have? So let's say we have a company with, you know, hundreds of employees, all with this setup. So let's say we have like 1,000 employee desktops. And let's say each is running 100 processes. And let's say each has 10 open files. So that would be, you know, 10. So that would be, sorry, that would be 1 million open file descriptors. So that's manageable. It's not great looking up something in a table of a million things. Not going to be the fastest operation, but it's probably, you know, pretty reasonable to do on one machine. But this isn't ideal. But our big questions with this scheme are going to come from how we deal with failures. Like, if we only have to worry about storing this information, you know, that's not going to be so bad. We're going to have to do some special stuff to manage what about local files, but you know, we could imagine having something that's based on this idea of let's just use open read write. That's what we send over the network. Where this gets tricky is when we think about failures. So let's have this example here. So let's say I have a client that hasn't sent anything to the file server in an hour. And our question is, well, can the server delete its open file information yet? The answer, as you can guess by me asking the question, is maybe not. So can someone give me their most plausible reason why the server wouldn't be able to do this? And as a hint, think about what if the client's a laptop? Any volunteers? Client is offline. Yeah, so client temporarily offline. So why would the client offline but has file open? So one example would be, you know, walked out of Wi-Fi range. take my laptop out of Wi-Fi range. Well, yeah, the server can't get anything from it for the hour I'm doing that, but that doesn't mean when I come back into Wi-Fi range that it shouldn't work. So that's probably the most plausible reason I can think of. There are other things we can think of, like client entered sleep mode. Like, I just, I shut my laptop and it entered power saving mode. Probably when I come back up, it's going to happen. And situations like this, this is kind of tricky for the server, because if the client crashes, we want to get rid of this information eventually. We'd like to do that, but, these sorts of things, is there a time limit here? Also, we need to, figure out which case it is. We don't have a good answer here. Now, the client crashing, so this is inconvenient. This is going to waste some space on the server. Mentioned we might be storing, millions of these entries, which, in modern terms, it's manageable. We have gigabytes of RAM, probably, on our server. Let's think about the other way around. So the client, failing, that's probably pretty common. We have lots of clients, but sometimes the server is going to fail. So let's say our server crashes. We're going to start a new, whatever's going to happen? Well, first we're going to start a new one. The question is, what are the clients going to do? And if the server is storing information about their file descriptors, well, the clients are basically useless because every file they have open on the server, they can't access anymore without reopening them. And if we wanted to force everything to be reopened, we probably need to just restart. And it sure would be nice to do better. So the question is, what information can we keep on the client so we don't need to restart? And we're going to change our protocol so the clients do keep more information. And we're going to do it in a way where the servers, in exchange, are going to be keeping less information. And in the process, we're going to sort of mitigate both these problems of what happens when things crash. That's going to be easier to deal with. And we're also going to limit the amount of work the server has to do. And I'm going to give you a concrete example of one of these protocols, which is going to be the network file system version 2. So this was standardized in 1989. It was designed for Unix-like systems, and it uses RPC calls. And the network file system, it's designed for Unix-like systems, but it doesn't have file descriptors. All that stuff is going to be managed by the client and hidden from the server. The server's not going to deal with file descriptors. There's not even going to be a notion of an open file. Instead, here's a select subset of the RPC calls that NFS version 2 exposed. So we have this lookup operation. We take a file ID. I'll talk about what that is later, but this is going to stand in for a directory or file and a file name, and it gives us another file ID. And then we can read from that file at a particular offset. Notice that we're passing in an offset to our read and write operations, kind of like you passed in an offset for FAT, rather than having the server track where we are in the file. We have a bunch of similar operations, get attributes for get the file size and so on, kind of like the stat operation some of you used in the FAT assignment, write, remove, and so on. So what are these file IDs? So these file IDs, from the client's point of view, is just some opaque set of bytes. The client has no idea what's in a file ID. All it knows is, I got a file ID from the server, and when I want to access that file, I give the server the file ID back. And the reason why the client doesn't get to know what's in the file ID is that the server can choose whatever is convenient for it to put in the file ID. And on a Unix-like system, the most common choice is to put a device and inode number plus a generation number. Say, why this? Well, if we think about how we're dealing with open files locally, this is going to be the same information we'd keep locally in a processes file descriptor table. So when we open a file, this is the information we're going to be storing. To find the file, we're going to say it's on this hard drive with this IDO number. We know what the file system is, and we can find the file information that way. So here, rather than storing a mapping from a file descriptor to that on the server, we're just having the server send that information to the client, and the client sends it back whenever it needs it. There's also this generation number. I'll talk about what that is later. And this ID is how we identify all files, so we don't have to like look them up, you know, do the directory traversal every time. And as I said, like we could change this depending on how our server works. So maybe if we had a FAT-based file system, we store like a cluster number or a directory entry here, if that were convenient. So on the client side, the client is going to store our list of open files. So it's responsible for storing the mapping from every process's file descriptor to what server is it, what file ID, and also where in the file are we. So everything it needs to know to construct these RPC calls. And if we look at our earlier question of like, when can we safely delete, you know, that information? Well, if the client machine crashes, the information is deleted automatically. We don't have to do anything. So this is sometimes known as fate sharing. The information has the same fate as everything else in the client machine. So we saved ourselves a bunch of work where, you know, we didn't come up with a fancier scheme to figure out whether the client was really offline permanently and crashed or not. Instead, by putting things on the client, we basically didn't have to think of this problem. And on the server side, you know, we get one of these file IDs, we just use it to find the file on disk. We can put whatever information we need to do that. You know, usually the IDO number, so we aren't like looking through directory entries every time the client wants to read something. And the server doesn't need to track any information except when the client actually wants to do a read or a write or something like that. We don't need to know about what the client has open at any time. Which means that if the server crashes, there's nothing to lose. You know, all the information we care about, it's on the disk, which we're using something like journaling to manage. So questions about this idea of file IDs. This protocol here. So question, if this is the case, what's the point of a heartbeat request? So in NFS version 2, there are no heartbeat requests. A heartbeat request is like, are you still alive? This is totally unneeded because the server doesn't actually care if the client is doing that. So they're not necessary in this protocol. And this is sort of why the protocol is designed this way. One of the design goals was to avoid the need for things like that. Does that answer your question? So question, can I explain fate sharing? So by fate sharing, I mean that we have a bucket that stores our file descriptor to file IDs and also has sort of the program we're running. If the program crashes, the whole bucket goes away because that's how, you know, our machine crashing works. So they have the same fate versus previously, you know, this was sort of our client. Previously, we had our client and our server, and we had that mapping stored on the server and the program on the client. If the client machine crashed, that mapping was still there. We didn't have fate sharing. They have different fates, you know, because they crash separately. Does that answer your question? Okay. So, I mentioned the generation number idea. So what is the generation number? So there's actually kind of a little problem with this scheme where I don't have the generation number. And that's because we aren't having the server track what clients are accessing a file. And something which could happen is we open up a file and someone else deletes it. And we think about that. So if someone else just deletes it, we discover, oh, that inode you're using isn't valid anymore. And that wouldn't be a problem. But we're going to eventually reuse that inode. And it might be the case that it's valid, but for a different file. A new file was created. We looked for a free inode. We found one. And that's a problem. Because that case, we could open up a file and then, you know, wait for a while and read from the file, but we're actually reading from something completely unrelated. And that would be really bad. So the solution is this generation number. And basically what this generation number is it's, you know, a count of how many times the inode has been reused. And the idea is that using this, we can detect if we're in this situation where the inode was reused since the client opened the file. Now, a question is, like, where do we store this information? And Linux file systems, just to support things like NFS, store an extra field in the inode, which is the generation number. There's no real other use for it. It's just for things like NFS. Just to detect this scenario so we can have you use these convenient IDO numbers and not have to like look up a path every time we do a read. But still detect that, oh, you're trying to access a file that was removed. Like, the read's not going to work, but we're going to say, sorry, the data isn't there, not, oh, here's some data, and it's wrong. So there's some trickiness to making this stateless protocol work, but you need to worry about like things changing from under us because we aren't keeping track of that information. But the net result is that we end up with what we call a stateless protocol. By stateless, I mean the server isn't storing information. No, server doesn't store things about the clients. Yes, the server stores things. It's a file, has a file system we're accessing, but it doesn't actually store information about what clients accessing the file system are doing. There's no open or close operation, and each operation stands alone. Each of these RPC calls, all the information we need is in the arguments. This read operation, I don't need a prior file that was open. I just have a file ID. And once I get a file ID, as long as the file still exists, I can keep using that file ID forever. The server doesn't need to like record a mapping of file IDs to make that work because it can put whatever it needs in the file ID. And we have this stateless protocol where the server doesn't need to remember anything. And we kind of use this rather systematic way to construct it from what was previously a stateful protocol, where the server needed to know a lot of stuff about all the clients, you know, in order for that to work. And we can see sort of the general pattern for this in how NFS's read-dir operation works. So read-dir returns directory entries, and it returns a limited number of directory entries. So you specify a count, how many you want, but then there's the question of, you know, if I ask for the first 100, how do I get the next 100? And the solution they use for that is they have this offset cookie. So what I mean by this, and this is just some opaque token. And if we think about doing read-dir with this, you know, get 100 entries at a time locally, the way that would work is you like open up the directory as some sort of file. You'd call read-dir, a read operation. Then you call the next read operation. And in between the two read operations, the local system will remember where you are. And we said here that we don't want the server to have to remember things about the clients. So what we've done is we've said, well, what the server would remember about the client is where they were in the directory. So rather than, you know, remember that on the server, we give that information to the client as some sort of opaque data. The client just remembers this piece of data, but it doesn't actually have to care about what it means. It doesn't know, you know, is it a number of bytes? Is it a number of directory entries? Is it a cluster number? You know, doesn't care. Doesn't need to know. All it does is when it wants the next stuff in the directory, it just passes that as this third argument. And this is sort of a general strategy we can use for making things stateless, that when we were worried about file descriptors remembering what file we had opened, we just gave that information to the client, had it echo it back to us, and so on. And this is a very general strategy that we see used all over the place when we want servers to have less work to do and not to have to be so concerned about how do I track, you know, what information about what clients are active and whether clients have failed and so on. Okay. So I mentioned that NFS was a stateless protocol, which means that we can kind of divide protocols into stateless and stateful protocols. So a stateful protocol, you know, previous things in the connection matter. In a stateless protocol, each request stands alone. And I gave NFS as an example of a stateless protocol. There's another very famous protocol which is stateless, which is HTTP. And if you know about web stuff broadly, you may know about cookies, which are sort of exactly this pattern of, you know, have the client remember something for the server that we've seen with NFS and file IDs. So that's HTTP's version of that. That's how we connect different web requests together. It's by having client remember things just like in NFS, how we connect like a request to look up a file and read it with this file ID. This is in contrast to stateful protocols, which sometimes we need. So your two-phase connect system is a stateful protocol because when you're actually changing something on one of the workers, you care about having done the prepare operation or your equivalent of that earlier. So, like, you know, you actually care about sort of what happened in sequence versus our stateless protocol where, you know, we want to make sure each request stands alone and have that, those nice properties that that gives us as far as making the server convenient to write. And sort of the big advantage of our stateless protocol is that it's less work for the server. You might say, well, you know, why would we care about that? You know, we only need one server, but, you know, the big thing there is that the server needs to handle lots of clients. It's the more complicated thing. And also, it's kind of natural to, you know, get rid of that ability, requirement for the server to, you know, figure out how clients are failing and so on. Versus a stateful protocol, you know, maybe that puts less burden on the client. So that might be, and there's some things that are, like, harder to make work, like two-phase commit without an actual stateful protocol. So, let's see. So, let's think about this idea. So, remember, stateless means that each request stands alone, so the server doesn't remember things about clients in between messages. So, let's think about what's possible with a stateless versus stateful protocol. So, which one of these, if we have a stateless file server, so something like NFS, but maybe not the same protocol, but still stateless, which features could we implement by adding, by, you know, doing something in the client and or server, but still have it be stateless? So the server doesn't remember things about clients in between requests. And we still have the client-server model, like the clients aren't working together behind the server's back. People seem very reluctant to reflect to things. Okay, getting better. Closer. Give another 20 seconds. Okay, so let's go through these. So everyone who answered agrees that this is possible, and I agree. This might be awkward, you know, e.g., like, a, you know, awkward, can we really do, really practically, or impractical, manage, you know, 8 gig plus single request? Like, that might be awkward, but it doesn't violate our stateless property. And most people think that D is possible, and this, I think, provided the client retrieved info about the file, about the directory earlier, you know, before the open. This is possible as long as the client retrieves some information about the record before the open, it can reuse that information under the assumption that other clients aren't manipulating it. If other clients were, then we'd have an inconsistency issue. Like, maybe the file was removed just before we opened it. And that's why everyone agreed that this was not possible, because what if file removed just before open? Open. Then the open would succeed even though it's not supposed to. So then we have the this one, which most people say no. So this is tricky. And you want to say no because there is a solution, but it seems really inefficient, so you probably don't want it to be the solution. But this is definitely possible. And yes, client checks, say, every 30 seconds. So the client can just ask the server, hey, did the file get updated? Did the file get updated? Did the file get updated? Every 30 seconds, and do this. It's not very efficient. It's probably not how you want to do that. It's a good case against doing this in a stateless way, but it is possible with a stateless system. So a stateful might be fast. A stateful might be better, might be more efficient than this. Okay. So questions on sort of my answers to these. Now, is there significance to 5 minutes? No. I just chose 5 minutes because it's clearly long enough to... It's clearly plenty of time in which to, like, contact the server and get a bunch of stuff. That answer your question? Okay. So, let's think about performance here. So, file servers, the way I've described them, are actually pretty inefficient. And this seems not intuitive because we think accessing disk is slow. But remember, usually on a local system, we aren't accessing disk, which means that typically we're accessing the page cache. And so reads and writes and all these operations take microseconds. But now they're going to take milliseconds because that's sort of minimum time to go over the network, do RPC calls. And if we want to avoid inconsistency, we have to do RPC calls. And why do we have to do that? Well, you know, let's say I want to cache something locally. I want to do what I would have done if it were a local file system. There's a question of, well, if the file I have cached gets updated, how do I know? And there's a solution. We just ask the server every time we're checking that cache copy, is it updated? Problem? That this is about as fast as actually getting the data for a small file like notes.txt. Another thing is that if we modify the file, you know, we'd like to just update it in our cache and not spend the time contacting the server right away, but we can't do that because we need to make sure another client reading it sees the updated version. So caching is really challenging with a stateless server because, you know, otherwise, how do we get notified if it changes? It seems like we have to contact the server all the time, which is about as slow as, like, you know, accessing data. It's going to defeat the entire Bennett point of caching. So, like, we could just check every time, but we defeat the point of caching. But caching is really important to get good performance. We really don't actually want to contact the server for every file operation, because that's going to be so much slower than the files were actually local. Now, Network File System version 3, the one after the version 2 I showed you, said, caching is important. We're going to allow caching. But they decided they were still going to have a stateless protocol. You might say, how did they do that and still make caching worthwhile? And their solution, probably going to disappoint you, they allow inconsistency. They just said, we're going to allow some inconsistency. There's just another solution some other network file systems use, which is that they don't have a stateless server anymore. They have the server remember who has the file and contact them, but this means that the server needs to go through the extra work of what if one of those clients fails and so on. So I'm going to look at this allowing inconsistency. How does that work? And the key idea is that they still have some hard rules about contacting the server, that when you close a file, you always update the server. And when you open a file, you always check, hey, do I have the latest version? And the idea is that as long as we're like loading a file all at once or saving a file all at once, everything works correctly. We only run into problems if we have two programs on different machines with the file open at the same time. So we're still, you know, once we have the file open, we're still using a cached version, so it's like it's local. But, you know, so we still get most of the consistency we care about, even though we've made this compromise to not have our server track who has the file proactively and deal with all the failure cases and so on. Okay. So questions on this sort of compromise to still do reasonable caching without having the server track everyone who has a file? So this is sort of a practical solution, and you know, it works most of the time. So that's where I'm going to finish up on distributed systems. So our next topic is going to be about security. And to talk about security, we'll talk about sort of two vocab terms. So one is protection. So protection means mechanisms in operating systems for controlling access to resources. So for example, page tables control access to physical memory. They determine what physical memory you can access, whether you can read or write it. So they're a mechanism for providing protection of memory. They protect how, you know, who can access memory, but they don't determine what memory you can access in the sense that how the page table is set up does that. So the mechanism is page tables, but there's some policy about how the page tables are set up. And that policy, we want to have particular security properties to prevent misuse of physical memory. So for example, when setting up page tables, I want to keep you from overwriting the kernel's code. So that's a policy I have. Or I want you to keep you from reading sensitive data. And the policy is often sort of very big. And our main goal as an operating system writer is going to be to provide flexible mechanisms, so provide protection that's flexible enough for many policies. In this class, we're not going to talk much about what the policy should be and so on. We're going to talk about providing mechanisms that are going to be good enough for whatever policy people might come up with. Okay. So we're focusing on mechanisms, but remember there's some policy decision. We're kind of punting on that and just saying we're going to just provide enough so all the interesting policies can happen. Now, note that when we're talking about the security goals we're trying to achieve with our protection, you want to prevent misuse. And a key thing about this is that we're going to be worried about adversaries. And adversaries do the worst possible thing. So with page tables, for example, you know, we might think, you know, page tables, they keep us from accidentally overwriting the kernel's memory, or they make sure our program crashes if we go out of bounds. Those are useful things that page tables do, but they aren't going to help us with our security very much because our adversary is going to be clever enough to choose the one page table entry we've set incorrectly. You know, the adversaries are always going to do the most clever possible thing They're not going to make mistakes. They're going to, you know, deliberately misuse the, you know, access they have. You know, and what we're trying to do is prevent that deliberate misuse, not just mistakes. So, yes, like a purpose of page tables to catch mistakes, like going out of bounds of your stack, but that's not going to help us with our security. With our security, our adversary is going to figure out, you know, how to actually do the exact thing they want, if it's possible, with the page table we've set up. Now, when talking about these security policies, a common attribute that these policies we want to enforce have is that they specify sort of people or users or some notion of an individual or organization responsible for our program. So an important thing that's going to come up is figuring out who, what process represents what person or organization. And there are sort of two parts to this problem. So one part is something we'll call authentication. This is figuring out who is who. So authentication is like, am I logging into the machine or are you? And an example of how we do authentication is with a password. And there's a separate problem after that. If I'm logged into the machine, what can I do? And this is the problem we're going to be focusing on. Now, obviously, to figure out who can do what, we need to know who is who first. So, you know, password, etc. But we're going to kind of say that someone else does this and tells us, and I'll talk about the mechanism for that later, but the operating system point of view, we're going to mostly be focusing on this problem. We're going to have already figured out, you know, a mapping from programs to who's running it, and based on that, the main thing we're going to talk about is how do we actually decide what they're allowed to do. And we'll go back to the problem of, well, how do we establish that mapping in the first place? How do I mark this program's running on behalf of this person? But we're going to punt on that to begin with and just assume we have that mapping. So I want to represent who can do what. I'm going to have this abstract representation, and I'll talk about how we actually sort of encode this. But our abstract sort of idea is that we're going to have an access control matrix, that somehow we're going to represent this big giant table, which we're obviously not going to store every single entry because it's going to end up being huge, where we have a bunch of what I call protection domains. And each process belongs to one or more of these protection domains. And these might correspond to users, so a user I log in as, or groups. And process is assigned to a bunch of these, and each object, so files, processes, anything that we may or may not be allowed to access depending on, you know, authorized access depending on who the program is running on behalf of, we have entries for what operations are allowed. So for example, for file one, user processes in domain one, which maybe is my user, can read or write it, and processes in domain two or three can just read it. And the idea is that we're going to, you know, look up this matrix information whenever a process tries to read or write a file, or actually turns out open a file, and then use that to determine whether that access is allowed. So one question is, how do we represent these domains? So we're going to have to store information with each process to do that. And what form does that take? By far the most common form is that we're going to have what is called a user ID. So this is going to be typically a number that's associated with each process. And each process is going to have this in its process control block. So this is going to be stored in the kernel. And this user ID is going to determine what the process is allowed to do. So we aren't going to store names, we're just going to store this number. And that number is somehow going to be mapped inside the kernel to what operations are allowed. So this is an extra thing in our process control block. And POSIX stores these. So POSIX actually stores several user IDs. We'll mention briefly why later. But the important one is called the effective user ID. And this you can access with get EUID. That's a library call to get it. And this is the number tracked by the kernel. And this is used for all the permission checks, you know, all the are you authorized to do things. Now you might say, this is just a number, but when I log into a system, or when I look at what file listing, I see names, how does that work? So on Unix-like systems, this is maintained typically outside the kernel. So the programs and the libraries maintain this number to name mapping, but the kernel doesn't know about it, doesn't care. All it sees is numbers, and there's some database outside it for just displaying these names as these numbers as names that it doesn't care about. So I also showed you the idea of having groups, like a group for faculty. And POSIX also assigns these to processes. So processes have one or more group IDs. And again, the kernel only knows numbers. So like with user IDs, there's some standard mapping. And if I log into one of the department machines, for example, there's a command called ID, which displays all of its own IDs and groups, user IDs and group IDs. And it also looks up in the database, the standard libraries database, what those map to as names. So you can see, you know, this is my user ID on department machines, and I'm in group CS faculty, instructors, and CS4414. Now, it might seem from this that the idea of groups is kind of redundant with the user ID, that I can tell what groups you're in from the user ID, but this doesn't have to be the case. So for example, maybe I want some programs to be able to access my monitor, and I want that to be based on, did I log into the machine in person? And you can enforce this kind of policy with groups. They're handy for that because you can start processes that were started from the machine sitting in front of the machine in this video group and start processes where I SSH in, not in this video group. So that's a way where groups allow you to do things that are maybe finer grained than just, you know, what assigning things to users do. At least this is the theory. In practice, maybe this doesn't work out because I can keep something running in the background. But that's kind of the idea, is that groups don't have to be like just more information about a user. They can also be something special that you're temporarily allowed to do. So we have these users and groups. So that gives us this part, you know, that figures out which rows of the table. So we know that that's stored in the process control block, and we just use opaque IDs that we don't deal with names. And then we have to represent the meat of this table, you know, for each file and process, what are those allowed to access? And there's two common schemes for this, and we're gonna focus on this first one, known as access control list, which I'll use as a general idea. And this is basically with each file or other object, like a process, we store a list of who's allowed to use it and what operations they're allowed to do. An alternative is that we can have like just like a hash table indexed by domain object giving us what you're allowed to do. That's actually done in some cases, but by far the most common is like with each file, we store a list of who's allowed to access it, for example. And we could do the same for things like processes and any other resource where we want to restrict who can access it based on what user they are. So POSIX does this for files, and there's two ways POSIX has some sort of access control list. The first one is the one that's widely supported, which is a very, very restricted access control list. Restricted by which I mean sort of, you know, limited number of entries in that list. By limited, I mean really limited. It contains a user ID who is the owner of the file and can change permissions. There's no one else who's allowed to change the permissions. And you can set whether that user can read, write, or execute the file. It contains one group ID, and whether that group can read, write, or execute, and a default for anyone who isn't the user or group, whether they can read, write, or execute. If you use chmod before, chmod manipulates this very small access control list. So this allows us to, you know, this is stored with the files, you know, so this is stored, you know, in inodes typically, and indicates who can access the file. And we enforce this by checking when you open the file against this list. Now, this is extremely limited in functionality. So POSIX added, and other OSs like Windows have had, more flexible access control lists that aren't limited to one user ID and one group ID and one default. And POSIX has a version that's standardized, but I mention it second because it's usually not supported. It's very much less commonly supported. But the way that looks is that you can just specify a freeform list. So here I have a file, students can read or execute it, faculty can read, write, or execute it, MST3K can read, write, or execute it, and TJ1A can do nothing. And you notice that you might match multiple categories, and POSIX just defines a rule as to which takes precedence. Their rule is user entries take precedence. So TJ1A, even if they're students or faculty, can't access it. MST3K, even if they're a student, can write the file with this set of rules. So this is the more flexible way, which is said less well supported, but this is sort of what's possible with access control lists. So we have this way of storing our information about, you know, what users and groups are allowed to access it. We have an association between users and groups and processes by storing IDs for them in the process control block. And those IDs, when we store this in the file system, we'll also store the ID for this group, the students group, the faculty group, and the MST3K user and the TJ1A user. We'll store those as IDs, as numbers. And when we call system calls, most notably when you open a file or when you do other operations like renaming or deleting, we'll check those permissions on system call entry. Notice that we're going to do this in the kernel. We can't do it outside the kernel because a program could make a system call directly and bypass any checks that weren't in the kernel. So we have to do it in the kernel, and we just check against this list against the current process. Okay, so questions? About this idea, where we do, you know, storing our authorization information and doing the checking. Okay. So now we've gotten to a point where we have a way of enforcing restrictions on processes, sort of assigning them to particular users, but I haven't said how we set that up initially. And one problem is, like, how do processes get assigned these user IDs and so on. And to talk about that, we're going to have to talk about a special user ID in POSIX systems. So user ID 0 is known as super user or root. And super user or root basically has a, you know, special row in that access control matrix, 0, where every entry for that user implicitly says everything. So it automatically passes all, or at least almost all, permission checks. So it's a special case for this user ID 0, why it's called super user. Also, commonly, some operations will only be allowed for this user ID, like maybe shutting down the system. And this user ID, special user ID, is what we're going to use to set up our other user IDs. And it's going to be important that we have this most privileged user ID that can set up the other user IDs. So with that in mind, let's look at logging into a machine. We have, you know, I type a username and a password, and then I get a shell running as that user. And this is not done by the kernel. This is some program is outputting these prompts and checking the password. So there's a program which checks if the password is correct, and then changes user IDs and runs a shell. And obviously we can't let just anyone change user IDs. So this change user IDs operation is going to be possible because the program runs as UID 0. We're going to run the program as UID 0, which is going to allow it to change user IDs. Now, They ask, well, how does it check if the password is correct? And on a typical Unix-like system, the kernel knows nothing about passwords. But we still want to make sure that, you know, not just anyone can find passwords. And we're typically going to use the same mechanism we use to prevent for access control of files to protect this information. So in a single user system, we'll make a file and we'll make it only readable by UID 0. We'll just set an access control list with, you know, that says only UID 0 can access this. And, you know, UID 0, we don't even need to say that because UID 0 can access anything. If we're on a multi-user system, we'll have some sort of network service that we can contact in some way to verify who is who. That's checking the password. And this is, and we can rely on this program running as a separate user ID to make sure that not just anyone can check any password. And this also means that if we want to change how passwords work, we can do that without changing the kernel. Then changing user IDs. Since this program runs as root, there's a system call it can call, and normal programs can't just change to any user ID, but as root, it can do that. So it calls the setUID call, and that sets its user ID to an arbitrary value. So it starts a super user, then it calls this to not be super user anymore before it starts the shell. And so this is how we can bootstrap, you know, being able to have a privileged program let you log in, but then things after that run as a normal user, so you can't just use that program to do anything. So questions about this idea? Okay, so for logging in, it made sense that our login program could just start running when the system boots as this special user ID that can do anything. But you've probably, if you've used our VM, for example, or some other VMs, you may have used a command called sudo. And what sudo does when used like this is it runs a command with super user permissions, but you run it as not super user. And it would be really bad if just any program could like call setuid 0 and start being super user. That would defeat the entire purpose of all our access control lists we talk about, because they wouldn't mean anything if the program was a little bit clever. But we somehow have a way where we can run a program and something ends up running as root. So how does this happen? And the answer is that there's some extra information on the program. There's an extra bit of metadata we store with executables called a setUserID bit. And if it's set, then when we call exec on that executable, in addition to starting the new program, loading that program, it changes the current effective user ID to the owner of that executable. So sudo is owned by root, that's UID 0, and marks that UID. So it gets to run as root, just like our login program did. And that's because when it was installed, a command like chmod u plus s was run to set that special flag to say, run this as the owner of the file, as UID 0 in this case. And so the sudo program, because it's running as root, it can check the password and it can, you know, make a decision to allow you to run this restart command when you enter the right password. And that can be configured, you know, different ways depending on who installed the sudo program and set it up. And this set user ID idea like gives us this very general mechanism where we can provide controlled access to things that users can't normally do. So if we can't set up our access control lists to allow the functionality, like we don't have a way of giving you access to the restart operation in the kernel, that's fine. We can have a set user ID program that does that for you, and it can make decisions about what's allowed for that. And on Unix-like systems, these are used all the time. So for example, most commonly, if you mount a USB stick on a Unix-like system, this uses a set user ID program. And why? Because the system call that actually mounts things, well, that there's some ways that could be used where we can't just allow any user to do that. For example, we have to make sure you aren't replacing a sensitive directory with some data from a USB stick. You have to make sure you aren't, you know, hiding files or overwriting files. We have to make sure you aren't messing up a normal hard disk. We want you to be able to mount USB sticks, but not any random thing. You know, we don't want you to be able to mount a new file system if you aren't system administrator. We also don't want you to be able to create new set user ID executables by mounting. And we could imagine modifying the kernel to enforce all these properties, but instead we have a program you run which controls the options to the system call to make sure that everything's okay, to make sure you're only allowed to mount USB sticks, for example, and only allowed to, you know, set them up to appear in a certain place. We also might use this for other things, like we can access the printer for you and make sure that, you know, you aren't printing too many pages or sending things that are going to break the printer, and so on. So set user ID programs, you can think of as a kind of very nice mechanism where the kernel decided that some things are only for root to do. And we could change the kernel to make that decision a little more nuanced, but instead of doing that, instead of needing to modify the kernel, we write this set user ID program that gives controlled access to that thing only root can do, and therefore lets us make the decision about who can do it. And you can kind of think of this as like sort of a sort of user space analog of system calls. The hardware made a decision that some things are only for the kernel to do. And when we want to allow programs to access that functionality, we make a system call. Like if we want to allow you to print something to the screen, which only the kernel can do, we make a system call that lets you do that. And that system call lets the kernel make the decision about who's allowed to do that instead of the hardware. In the same way, writing set user ID programs lets whoever installs these programs make the decision about who can do the operation instead of the kernel without changing the kernel. So, questions about this idea of gating to a higher privilege? Okay, so set user ID programs are nice and flexible, but they're also, in fact, extremely hard to make secure. I'll give an example. So let's say I have a shared server, like one of the, like Portal or something like that, and I have a directory with grades on it, I have a folder for each assignment, and in that folder I have a text file with each user's grade. And I don't have flexible access control lists, so I can't like actually set each of these text files to be accessible by the right users. I can just like make them all, you know, only readable by me, but I don't have an easy way of like exposing them to another user. So I'd say, well, that's fine. I'll make a set UID program to work around that. Because I can't set the access control list right, I'll just make a program, print grade, where you specify your assignment, it looks up your user ID, and outputs your grade from the file with your based on your computing ID. Okay. So it sounds like a reasonable idea. So let's say I write this set user ID program. And this program, it's not very long, it's not doing something particularly complicated, and it's extremely insecure. So can someone give me an example of one of the ways in which it is extremely insecure? There's like lots of ways in which it is extremely insecure. And that's scary, because this is not a complicated program, and yet there's tons of things that can go wrong. So one is buffer overflow. Yes, so that's one. Flow. So that's one problem. So I'm using this getENV to get the user ID. You know, this is set for convenience by shell. So this is something we got from the shell. But it might not match the actual computing ID. So this user environment variable is something the shell sets to be convenient, but I should actually ask kernel for the user ID, kernel for my UID, and look up in the database. So you mentioned we had a database. Yeah, so that's something I need to do. So another problem someone mentioned is that argv1 could be a sensitive directory. Yeah, so I'm just putting a directory name in here. And you might say, well, there's no sensitive directories in all grades as long as we're looking for the right computing ID name. But this could be, but my argv1 could be like ....../.../.... exam stuff. Or something like that. And that could be a problem. So many things wrong just in the first three lines. We have some other issues. Probably the most subtle issue is that we're opening the file read-write. And that doesn't seem like a problem. We're only reading from it. How could that go wrong? Well, what file descriptor gets returned here? It's whatever the next one available is. And this printf writes to FD number 1. And if FD1 isn't open when we call open, then open could return 1. And we could print to the file that we're supposed to be outputting. Yeah. So just a huge amount of things in this extremely trivial program. And this is sort of the common experience if you're trying to make a secure setuid program, that you are like, it is really tricky to figure out how to make it secure. It's possible. The authors of Sudo, for example, have done a really careful job and generally avoid these problems. But it's not like, it's not actually trivial to do. Now, one special class of problems that occur when we're writing set user ID programs is when we want to do sort of delegation of part of a functionality. So let's say I have a program that I mark set UID to access a printer. The printer can't be accessed by everyone, so I have a set user ID program that accesses the printer, and it's, you know, print file, and, you know, this is how I run it. And the idea is the program opens this file and sends it to the printer. Can the program just call open? And the problem is that it can open things the user is not supposed to see. Like we can open another student's grade file. That would be bad. We don't want that to be possible. So you might say, okay, so we just need to be a little careful when writing this printing program. So here's my proposed solution that doesn't work. We first do a check if the original user can read the file in the argument, then we open the file. And this seems like it's fine, right? We're checking if the user can open the file before we open it, what could go wrong? And the problem is there could be a race. And the reason why is that we check, can the user open it? We get a yes answer. The yes answer is real. We aren't being deceived. But then the file changes under our nose. The simplest way to do this on POSIX is that we can delete the file and link makes a new directory entry that points to an existing file. Because the directory entries just contain an inode, we can have two directory entries that point to the same inode. That's allowed. You might say, maybe we just shouldn't have that link feature. There's other ways this could happen, like we could rename the file. We could make a symbolic link, which is just a pointer that's supported for convenience. Or we might say, what if we don't allow any of those for files you can't access? We could do something like give a file name of a file that's about to be created by a privileged program. So let's say, for example, the password changing program writes a temporary file. Well, let's create a temporary file with that name, run the print program, delete the temporary file, run the password changing program, and if we time things just right, we print out the temporary file. And that would be bad. But regardless of how we do it, we have this problem that the file we're checking the access of and the file we're opening might be different files. And this is known as a time to check. This is the time of check. I should say, time of check to time of use vulnerability. This is the time of use, that there's some gap here, and this can lead us to having our set user ID program do something pretty bad. So this is a really tricky problem to deal with from our set user ID program. And this gets us back to a solution to this. It's going to get us to something that kind of I alluded to earlier. When I talked about user IDs, I said that we have this system call to get the effective user ID because there's some other user IDs. And the other user IDs exist to support a particular way of dealing with this problem. And that's that we can have our set user ID temporarily change to the original user, do the open, and then change back. And POSIX supports having a process having multiple sets of user IDs to support this temporarily go back to the original user operation. So our printing program can say, I need to open the file now, become the user who ran me, open, go back, and the open will use the ID of the original user for all its access controlist checks. And we don't have to worry about, are we really opening the same file we check the permissions of? Okay, so that's one of the big motivations behind having this ability, having multiple user IDs, is to provide a clean way for set user ID programs to avoid this kind of problem. Okay. So questions about time to check, to time of use vulnerabilities, or this idea of temporarily switching back to other users? Okay, and one thing you might say is that it seems awfully hard to squeeze into this little piece of time. I note that there are ways of making that more practical. So one of the common one that's kind of clever and notable is that you can do this by creating a whole bunch of symbolic links, which are looked up by name, and just slow down this open operation, by setting up the directory to make things slow. That is a thing that you can do to make this is actually a very practical thing an adversary can do. Okay, so I guess I'll end with this question here. So let's say we want to fix the vulnerability without using that temporarily change users idea. Which of these would work to do that? I guess I'm about out of time. So I'll explain things as we're finishing up voting, or I guess we'll hold in. Okay, so most people fell for my trap here, an A. So this solves this problem here, but the problem is that we can do this operation in reverse right here before we have the second check. So we have a second check here, but we can squeeze in another unlink and link something that works in between, and we could break both of the checks. Yes, it would be harder, harder to get timing right, but still a problem. So yes, we solved that problem, but there's a variant of the attack which would have a little more tricky timing, but we'd still eventually get it. Note that a big thing about why these are bad is that often I can run that printing program like a million times until it works. So we might have to try an extra million times, but that's not actually a problem. For B, this would work because once we've opened the file, we know it won't change. It won't become a different file. So when we open a file, it's going to stay the same file, so we don't have to worry about someone changing what the file is. If it's a file that the user can edit before, it's still going to be one. When we, it's not going to be a different file that was renamed from elsewhere. And this is because file descriptors on Unix correspond to sort of inode numbers. They correspond to an actual file, not a name. C doesn't work because the user can change things in the parent of parent directory. Can go two directories up and change something there. Okay, so questions about my answers here? So that's where I'll leave off for today.